And Arif's prepared a handout, so these could be distributed. If I start them here and take one, pass them along the row, and ensure that everybody gets one. So it's a great pleasure. It's a delight to introduce Arif Ahmed, who is reader in philosophy at the University of Cambridge. That's right, isn't it? Reader in philosophy. And Arif has published widely in several areas of philosophy, including decision theory, the philosophy of David Hume, Wittgenstein, philosophy of science, and philosophy of religion. His books include Wittgenstein's Philosophical Investigations, A Reader's Guide, and also A Critical Guide. So two books on Wittgenstein, Evidence, Decision and Causality in 2014, and a forthcoming book, I believe it's still forthcoming, The Value of the Future. Yeah, should be forthcoming, really. It's not going to be always forthcoming, but the Value of the Future. And Arif is particularly well known, I think, for engaging with, I suppose, primarily proponents of some form of theism in public debates. And if you wish to access any of those, they're freely available on YouTube, some of the public debates that Arif has participated in. So Arif's well known as a proponent of atheism and a skeptic about religious belief more generally. And he's going to provide for us a critical perspective on cross-cultural philosophy of religion today. So please join me in thanking Arif Ahmed for coming along and speaking to us.
Thank you very much, Mikhail, and thank you also for organising the conference. Yes, as Mikhail said, my views about religion can be summarised as follows, and the reason I'm saying this is because it's going to be relevant to the direction of my talk. I think religious claims are propositions which say pretty much what they seem to say. I believe all of those claims are false. I think Christian religion is false in its entirety, as is Islamic religion and many other religions. I have various views about the harms that religion inflicts and the benefits that it can bring. But it's correct to say that my views is pretty straightforwardly atheistic. And one element of that view, which is one that I think I share with many people in the analytic tradition, that perhaps not so many people here, for instance, in the analytic tradition of philosophy, is that religions are characterized at least in part by beliefs in these propositions. So that, for instance, there are distinctive beliefs in the Christian religion and in the Islamic religion and in a variety of other religious traditions across the world. That view, as you know, has come under pressure from other directions, I suppose most notably from anthropology. But it seems to me that, and it seems to a number of philosophers, and this is what I think explains the resilience of the idea that religion involves belief, that those arguments are not always especially effective. So if we think, for instance, of some of the things that Evans Pritchard, for instance, says somewhere that we shouldn't be talking about belief when we study religion because you can't observe beliefs, and the scientific inquiry should only be about what you observe, which seems very poor because, of course, science all the time discusses things that nobody can observe. Needham says, as you know, that the word belief, you know, covers a variety of different things. It's changed its meaning, and it could mean this or that. But of course, just because a word is ambiguous or polysemic, doesn't mean that we can't pin down some particular meaning that makes it useful as an index of a particular social phenomenon like religion. Maurice Rule has said that the notion of belief sort of originates in a Christian way of thinking about religion, and so is a kind of imposition on our way of understanding religions in other cultures. I've got a bit more sympathy for that way of thinking about things, but of course, making a claim about the specific origin of concept implies nothing about whether that concept can be fruitfully applied in other areas. Every concept has a specific origin in a particular time, place, and culture. It doesn't mean that it lacks universal application. So if there are reasons for thinking that there's something wrong with understanding religion as involving belief, there must be ones other than that. And today I'm going to say a bit about the kind of route that I find attractive for towards being sceptical about the idea that religion involves belief. And that route runs from Wittgenstein's philosophy, not really from his writings about religion or his writings about anthropology, but from the more central parts of his philosophy of mind. So most of the talk will be about sketching that route, and then towards the end I'll say a little bit about what I think the consequences of that are for the sorts of atheists, the sort of atheist that I take myself to be. The example that I'm going to start with, so now we're on the handout. Let me say a word actually about the handout. The handout should be four slides, and it's organised a bit like Ian's yesterday actually. So the first two slides are the drift of what I'm going to be saying, and then slides three and four are various quotations that I'll be mentioning in the course of the argument. And they're labelled with letters, which indicate where they appear in points 1 to 9 and page 22. The sort of position that I want to start by contrasting the one I'm going to end up at with is one that we find, for instance, in William James, and we also find it in a recent work by Tim Crane. The reason I mention that one is because I think it's an outstanding recent example of work in philosophy of religion by philosopher working in the central analytic tradition. And there Crane says, echoing James in fact, that religion does distinctively have a particular essential doctrinistic commitment. And it is a commitment to something like a belief in an abstract or supernatural order of things, which is a normative order. So something that you can't see and which determines the value of your life and which tells you how you should live. That's one thing we all have to believe in if we're going to be religious. And this is as stated, for instance, on passage A in the quotation. This is a quote from Crane. He says, according to James, when asked to characterise the life of religion in the broadest and most general terms, one might say that it consists in the belief that there is an unseen order and that our supreme good lies in harmoniously adjusting ourselves thereto. This belief is what I would call the religious impulse. One central theme of this book, i.e. Crane's book, is that James is partly right. The religious impulse is one of the two essential components of religious belief. So there is a second component, but Crane does think that the religious impulse, what he calls that, by which he means a belief, is a necessary condition of something being a religion. Now, as I said, the way I'm going to attack that idea is from the views that I think Wittgenstein to have. And so I'll start just by setting out a bit about what I think Wittgenstein's views are. And perhaps the best way to introduce that is to trace the evolution of his views in a very rudimentary way from the earlier period of his work to philosophical investigations. So as you know, Wittgenstein's first publication, his only major publication in his lifetime, was The Tractatus. And in that work, the details of which I won't go into now, he has as with everything, he has a very big discussion of belief. And the account of belief is essentially this, that to believe something is to have something like a picture in your mind. So there's all propositions are when you think pictures, and a belief is a kind of inner representational state which gets to be a belief because it's inside your mind and you sort of somehow think what it means in a way that makes it representational. These are as set out in passages B and C on the handout, which I won't go over. They are, as I said, typically opaque, but the general idea, I think, as I said, is clear enough, that the belief is an inner state which is representational in virtue of facts about the inner life of the subject. That's what makes something a belief. So on this view, whether something counts as a belief or not doesn't really depend at all on what you then go on to do with it. It counts as a belief simply by virtue of what you might call its intrinsic features, if those include the thinking the subject gets involved. Now, Wittgenstein changed his views about a number of things between the time that he wrote the Tractatus and the time of his later work, major work, Philosophical Investigations. And one of the things that he changed his views about was the nature of mental states quite generally. Philosophical Investigations itself does contain some, in the 570, section 570 onwards, it does contain some discussion of belief specifically, but a good deal of it, especially in the earlier parts, is really more to do with his account of mental states more generally. And I think we can learn something interesting about his picture of beliefs if we look at what he thinks about mental states. So I'll say something about that. So now what I'm talking about is his views in his later period after the Tractatus concerning what mental states are, and then I'm going to draw some consequences from that concerning what beliefs of that view are supposed to be. The first thing to bear in mind is that in his later period, he thought it was illuminating to distinguish between two different uses of mental state attributions. There's the first personal use, which I won't really be talking about here, when you say, I think something or I feel something. There's avowals, as philosophers call them. And then there's the third personal use, where you attribute a mental state to another person. And that's the third personal use, obviously, that's going to be relevant in ethnographic discourse, so that's the one that I'll be focusing on. And what Wittgenstein says about third personal use of mental state attributions is two, well, he says a number of things, but there are two things that I want to emphasize today. The first thing is that our understanding of them is essentially tied up with what he calls criteria, behavioral criteria. And what that means is that in order to grasp attributions of belief to another person, you have to be in a position to say, you have to know, what kinds of behavior manifest that state. So our understanding, I think what he's getting away from is his earlier view, and a view that many people find natural. Natural way to think about beliefs or any other mental state is to think, well, I've got one myself, I know what they're like from my own case, and then I can understand off the bat, straight off that, what it is for someone else to have them, because I just think what it is for me to have it. And then for Jones to have pain or to have a belief is just for him to have the same thing as what I have. That's the natural view that he absolutely rejects in Philosophical Investigations. To understand what it is for someone else to have a belief, to understand what's meant by saying Jones believes that P or Smith is in pain, is to grasp, you have to understand what kinds of behaviour those people are disposed to have, are disposed to display, on the basis of which you make attributions of belief. Now, such attributions are, of course, always defeasible. They don't entail the belief. But in order to understand what it is for Jones to have a belief, you must know that this kind of behaviour, in these sorts of circumstances, is evidence that he has that belief. That's how we understand third person attributions of beliefs and, more generally, other mental states. There is a complication here because he uses the word criteria, and there's a technical distinction in his philosophy between what's called criteria and what are called symptoms. But I don't think it's necessary to go into the details of that for the purposes of this exposition, and of course I'm happy to talk about it later. Okay, so to summarise what I've said so far about the later Wittgenstein, I said there were going to be two aspects of his mentalist philosophy that I wanted to discuss. One of them was the thing I just said, which is that attributions of mental states involve criteria, behavioural criteria. The second thing is that those behavioural criteria themselves need, the ones that are relevant to the attribution of a particular mental state, need not be sharply defined. So they may be vague, and in fact the kind of criteria that can be relevant to somebody's belief state or desire state or any other mental state form a family. So there's no one thing that's common to all state, all behaviours that evince a particular belief or that evince a particular desire. What that means is that when we grasp these things, we can't give an analysis of belief in these terms, in necessary and sufficient conditions for belief in terms of their criteria, but we can, as I said, understand that there's something like, you know, we can say Jones has a belief if he displays this kind of behaviour. That's grounds for saying Jones has a belief. We might change our mind later, but that's the sort of basis on which we enter into this way of thinking about other people. And we enter into the whole idea that other people have mental states as well as us. Of course, what he says about belief here or what he says about mental states here isn't confined to what he says about mental states. We all know that the central part of Philosophical Investigations is to do with the existence of family resemblance concepts more generally, as of course for which the word game is an outstanding example, and of course the word relational is also an outstanding example. Indeed, the whole notion of family resemblance concepts is one that I suspect he got from William James, because there's a passage in the Varieties of Religious Experience where James talks about religion in pretty much the same way as Wittgenstein talks about games. Wittgenstein will doubtless have read that and absorbed that in some way. Now, Wittgenstein actually thinks that because the criteria for settling whether somebody is in a certain mental state are indeed vague and form a family, because there's no one bodily or external manifestation that we can tie to a particular mental state, there is a temptation because of that, because of the vagueness of the concept, to think that there must be something precise and determinate behind it. And that, indeed, for him is the whole source of the idea, the myth, as he thinks of it in his later work, that there's an inner spiritual mechanism or inner spiritual process which is where the mental resides. So the whole illusion that mental life goes on inside your head, for Wittgenstein, arises from the fact, or goes on somewhere behind your behaviour, arises from the fact that we have no one precise single delineation of the kind of activity or behaviour that evinces this or that particular mental state, and our dissatisfaction with that makes us think there must be something behind it. Now, he thinks that's a mistake, and he thinks it's a characteristic sort of philosophical mistake, as you might call it, or perhaps he might call it a grammatical mistake, but I don't see what's added by calling it that. This is actually as described in F on the handout, so I've already read that passage. This is the passage from Philosophical Investigations, where he says, we do hear, here he's talking about the mental state of, or the mental process of thinking of something, or meaning something. He says, we do hear what we do in a host of similar cases, because we cannot specify any one bodily action, which we call pointing at the shape, as opposed to pointing at the colour, for example. We say that a mental or spiritual activity corresponds to this with these words. Where our language suggests a body, and there is none there, and there is none, there we should like to say is a spirit. So for him, it's because of the, because there's no one bodily action, because there's no typical behaviour that goes with our mentalistic vocabulary, we're misled into thinking that there must be some specific state that constitutes something as a belief, or as a meaning something, or as a desire, or whatever it is that occurs behind them, and that is, he calls it mental or spiritual. And that indeed might be a reasonable diagnosis of the sort of view that he had in the Tractatus. That is to say, that thinking of something, believing something, is an inner process that has the status that it does, independent of your behaviour, and is just something that depends only on the thinking activity of the subject, in the subject itself. Okay, so far, let me just summarise what we've got to so far. I started out by setting out, giving an example of the idea that there is such a thing as religious belief, that religion involves belief in propositions. And then I said why I thought, you know, some arguments against that view are not especially compelling. Then I moved on to discussing Wittgenstein's earlier views about belief in the Tractatus. And then I trace, as I describe, the difference between that and the later views that we had in Philosophical Investigations, of which I try to isolate two elements, namely, first of all, that there are criteria of behaviour for the attribution of mental states, and second, that those criteria are vague and form a family. So now we can move on to the specific application of those Wittgensteinian ideas to the question of the attribution of beliefs. And here, in fact, I think it's striking that Wittgenstein's account is in many ways similar to the account that we find in contemporary economic theory, for instance, in fact, neoclassical economic theory, where we do think of belief as simply an artifact of people's choices. We don't think there's some belief as something that's behind one's choices, rather than belief as simply a kind of construction out of behaviour. Now, in economic science, that's done in a very precise and particular way, which means that it probably doesn't apply to people at all. But there's a certain affinity between, more than an affinity between that view and Wittgenstein's view of belief here. So that might be a way of helping to make it illuminating. But the reason that I mentioned that, other than that, was to cast light on the first lesson that I want to draw from Wittgenstein's view, which is that we mustn't think of people's beliefs as explaining their behaviour. So the reason, in my own case, the reason, and I suspect for many people, the reason for thinking, oh, surely religions involve belief, is because if you don't believe this stuff, why do you do any of it? If people don't believe in the thing that Christianity is supposed to be committed to, why do they go to church? Why do they pray? Why do they try to convince other people and all of the other things that we associate with the Christian, the Islamic, and other religions? So, you know, the whole range of kinds of behaviour seem inexplicable if we can't appeal to beliefs that are going on behind them. And now, the relevance of Wittgenstein's view is that on his way of thinking about beliefs, beliefs never explain anything in the first place, okay? What are beliefs in his view? They're not something that goes on inside your head behind the behaviour that produces it. If that's what they were, they would indeed explain in some way the behaviour. But they're not that, no. They are, if you like, summaries or statements that somehow are just our expectations about behaviour. So to say, it's very crude, but to say that someone believes something is to say he's in a kind of state that produces these or these or these effects. And if that's what it is to say that someone has a belief, you're not explaining those effects. You're simply describing it as being the state that has them. So beliefs on this view, if we get away from the idea that beliefs are meant to explain anything in general, then we lose the motivation for thinking in, for instance, the religious case, that we have to appeal to background beliefs in order to explain a wide variety of activities. That's one point that I think we can draw from what Wittgenstein says concerning beliefs. The second point is that there are going to be, because that really arises from the fact that Wittgenstein's views identify belief with, or the understanding of belief with, the grasp of behavioural criteria. The second point is that because these criteria are vague and imprecise in the form of family, there's a wide variety of them, there may very well be cases where we don't know what to say, where there simply isn't an answer to be given to the question of whether a person has belief. Because our concept, as it framed as it is in terms of patterns of behaviour, might simply not be precise enough to settle that question. Wittgenstein gives an example of how that might happen in another case, in section 80 of Philosophical Investigations, which is part G on the handout. Just an example about a chair. So imagine this case. So I say there's a chair over there. What if I go and fetch it and suddenly it disappears from sight? So it wasn't a chair, but it's some kind of illusion. But a few seconds later we see it again and are able to touch it and so on. So the chair was there after all, and its disappearance was some kind of illusion. But suppose that after a time it disappears again or seems to disappear, what are we to say now? Have you rules ready for such cases? Rules saying whether such a thing is to be called a chair. But do we miss them when we use the word chair? And are we to say that we don't really attach any meaning to this word because we aren't equipped with rules for every possible application of it? The answer then is evidently no. Clearly we can use the word, we attach a meaning to it, even though the concept simply doesn't apply to a variety of cases. I think a lot of philosophical problems can just be got rid of in that way, because there are a lot of... I do think philosophers sometimes spend time on stupid problems because the words that they use them simply don't settle the question. Is the axe of Theseus or the ship of Theseus the same as this ship or the same as that? Well, you can say what you like. You know where the planets went. There's no further question to be answered except by semantic theory. The reason that I bring this up now is because similar things are going to apply in the case of psychological attributions. Once you get away from the idea that whether somebody is in a mental state or not is a fact about what's going on inside their head, and rather that his application is determined solely by what we can warrant on the basis of what they do, there are going to be cases where what people do simply doesn't fit any of the patterns that we're used to, or the basis of which we naturally apply the notion of belief, or of any other mental state. And if that does happen, then it may be that there are cases where the category of belief is simply not useful, it's simply pointless, for purposes, for instance, of ethnographic description. And my suspicion, and this is where the argument is going to go, is that that's what's happening in the case, in many cases, with religion. An example of a philosopher who I think has a similar kind of view, though again coming at it from a different perspective, was Quine, who wrote around the same time, a little bit after Philosophical Investigations. He wrote in H, he said, "In the strictest scientific spirit, we can report all the behaviour, verbal and otherwise, that may underlie our imputations of propositional attitudes," that means beliefs and other mental states, directed propositions. "And we may go on to speculate as we please about the causes and effects of this behaviour, but so long as we don't switch muses, the essentially dramatic idiom of propositional attitudes, i.e. beliefs, will find no place." So for him, again, scientific attributions of belief don't really fit into what counts as the explanation of behaviour. It's not doing that kind of thing, and it should have no place in the precise scientific description of our subject matter. Okay. Now, in the next part of the talk, I'm going to say, apply these points to the case at hand more specifically. And I'll do it by means of identifying three sort of aspects of belief, or the kinds of behaviour or places in which we attribute belief, that I think are going to be relevant, and then say a little bit about why we might expect to find various kinds of religious practice, for instance, that don't neatly fit any of them, certainly that don't fit all of them. These are the three kinds of phenomena on the basis of which we typically attribute beliefs, or that we can learn about the basis of belief attributions, are the guidance of action, responsiveness to evidence, and the third aspect, which is a kind of normative aspect, which is one stance towards others, that I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment. Now, when it comes to the guidance of action, there are things which we uncontroversially regard as beliefs, which clearly guide or relate to our actions in very straightforward ways. So that, for instance, we know what to expect if you say that someone thinks that it's raining, or someone believes that today is Wednesday, or that we're in Leeds. All of that will lead to perfectly predictable and unsurprising consequences for their behaviour, and in particular, it will kind of saturate their behaviour. Right? So because I believe that we're in Leeds, you know, anything that I do that depends on whether we're in Leeds is going to be affected by that belief. You know, what I say to somebody, they ask me where I am, what kinds of maps I look at, what train timetables I'm looking at, and so on. Now, in the case of religion, I think the thing is nothing like this clear-cut. That is to say, if there are religious beliefs, they really don't typically saturate one's behaviour in the way that everyday beliefs do. It's not peculiar to religion, but it is, I think, something that's reasonable to say about religion. On the various kinds of examples you can give. I mean, one example concerns, for instance, is something I always found plausible, the things that Albert Schweitzer said about Jesus' moral teachings, which is that they just, you really can't follow them. Okay? You might believe that they're right, but we really can't go through life turning. The only way, the reason you can go through life turning the other cheek is if you thought the end of the world was coming in a few days' time. But if you didn't think that, you just can't do these things that we're all supposed to say we aspire to as a moral ideal if we're Christians. Or another example, perhaps slightly less controversial, not for religion, would be the example of David Hume. The Hume, as you probably know, in a famous passage, describes his own philosophical attitude, which is one of scepticism, but then says that he just can't live according to that. So that when he goes off to have drinks with his friends and so on, he just forgets about his anxieties concerning the self and induction and all of these other things. So insofar as he can be said to believe that he has no self, or to doubt that he has a self, if that is indeed relevant to his behaviour, then it seems reasonable to say that it doesn't affect his actions in the way that, for instance, why we're aware of these affects my actions. Or examples concerning, I mean, perhaps a slightly more neutral example, when people write about conversion to various sorts of systems, like witchcraft, for instance, you know, one doesn't just start believing these things, one enters into certain kinds of practices, and one has them in some places and not in others, and one can be said to believe in witchcraft in one place and not in another. And these come from ethnographic studies of witchcraft in modern times, not in the 17th century. So these are all examples of ways in which we can distinguish the kinds of behaviour that are supposed to be predicated on religious beliefs and the sorts of things that are genuinely bona fide beliefs. That's an important difference, I think, which should certainly make us reluctant to regard belief as the correct index of the inner life of the devotee. The second aspect of belief that I mentioned, the second aspect, or rather, of things people do that make you want to say they believe something, was responsiveness to evidence. And here again, I think there's a distinction worth remarking between what happens in the religious case and, or in a variety of religious cases, and what happens in the everyday case. So, for instance, with everyday beliefs, such as, you know, the weather today, or what day of the month it is, or where we are, or the results of the next election, or you know, anything you care to mention, we seem to regulate our behaviour on the basis of evidence in a pretty straightforward way. In the case of religion, that seems not to be true. And here I'm not saying all religious people are like this, I'm saying many of them. So that, for instance, we can say on the one hand that there is indeed a thriving sort of apologetics industry, and there are people who do genuinely believe these things, and their minds are either changed or reinforced by arguments and evidence. And conversely, it's also true that there are people who do things like seeking to avoid evidence against their beliefs. So that there's evidence of people who pray for miracles that don't obviously violate laws of nature. So to speak, for someone to change their mind rather than for some physically impossible event to happen. And you might think, well, that also shows responsibility to evidence, because really they want to avoid any kind of evidence that would decisively undermine their beliefs. On the other hand, you also have people whose beliefs clearly don't, if that's what we want to call them, clearly don't respond to evidence in anything like a systematic and natural way. Young Earth creationism is an example, I suppose. Doomsday cults are a very interesting example, I guess, but there, you know, we all know of cases where they all predicted that the world was going to end, and then it didn't, but then they carried on believing the system that made them think the world was going to, or they carried on adhering to it, rather. So there are cases, I mean, even setting aside the really controversial cases where you think that people's belief in miracles and various other things is Hume thought, you know, can't be explained on the basis of evidence. It must be explained on some other basis. So there is a best equivocal relationship, I think, between religious forms of life, if you want to call them that, and evidence that we don't find in the everyday case. And that was the second feature of religion that I wanted to mention, which makes reluctant to think that the category of belief can be unequivocally applied here. The third thing third aspect of belief that I want to mention is really to do with a feature of belief which I think is distinct to it. It doesn't apply to other than states, just to do And this is that beliefs have a kind of normative load built into them, the way that, for instance, desires don't. What do I mean by that? Well, if you believe a proposition, then you believe that it's true. Okay? If you believe that something's true, then you must believe that people who disagree with you are wrong. Contrast. People who believe something contrary are wrong. Contrast. If you want something, it doesn't mean you think that people who want something different have made any sort of mistake. There's no normative bearing on my stance towards others from my wanting something, but there is a normative bearing on my stance towards others from my believing something. And this means that belief contains, if you like, an inevitably coercive element. And yet we're all familiar with examples of people who take what seems to be equivocal based on beliefs in an inexplicably tolerant attitude towards relations of others. So if you think, for instance, that here are these very important the most important questions that we face in our lives, to which I believe that this is the answer or that is the answer, this other person's got it wrong, you know, why am I so I'm bothered by that. Why am I so, you know, surely the one thing I should be doing is telling them why they're wrong, getting them to change their mind, or indeed getting them to join my religion. But religious people, typically, at least for us now, are much more tolerant. That wasn't always true, but it is true now. I find that we have greater latitude that people allow to our religions. The attitude that I have in mind, the attitude that you would expect if it was a matter of belief, is the one that Gibbon describes in this passage, as with Gibbon. I'm not clear how accurate it was, but he expresses it very well, where he says in passage L, he says, an exclusive zeal for the truth of religion and the unity of God was as carefully inculcated in the new as in the ancient system. Every privilege that could... Here he's accounting for the spread of Christianity in chapter 15, the kind of the spread of Christianity. Every privilege that could raise the proselyte from earth to heaven, that could exalt his devotion, secure his happiness, or even gratify that secret pride which, under the semblance of devotion, insinuates itself into the human heart, was still reserved for the members of the Christian Church. But at the same time, all mankind was permitted and even solicited to accept the glorious distinction, which is not only of profit as a favour, but imposed as an obligation, etc., etc. So that's an example of the kind of attitude that I had in mind, and which you would expect people to have if really religion involved beliefs, rather than just, here I go around doing something and somebody else does other things, you know, a style of living or a taste or something like that. So for these reasons, because the relationship between religion and evidence, the relationship between religion and guidance of action, and the relationship between religion and one stance towards others, is in the ways that I've sketched different from the ways that you would expect, the ways you'd expect it to be if it involved beliefs. And given also that the very notion of belief is closely tied up with those patterns of behaviour, patterns of ritual and so on, the sorts of things that Wittgenstein talks about in some of the passages that I've put on a handout but haven't read out. And because that in turn arises from a Wittgensteinian philosophy of mind, Wittgenstein's way of thinking about what it is to attribute beliefs to Christ, I think it is reasonable to conclude that we should at least be hesitant, and I think I'd go further than that, we should probably not think of belief as a useful category if we're trying to have a reasonably general ethnography of religion. So I want to say a little bit finally about where that leaves the kind of position, the kind of person that I am, that is to say someone who's I have a lot of sympathy for what's called the new atheist position. I'm not sure, as I said, religious propositions are repulsive, they're charging, it's very harmful than it does. But in the views of many new atheists, certainly in the case of Dawkins and Sam Harris, those views are predicated upon the attributions of beliefs to religious. So if you reject that, you know, I can still hold that religious propositions are false, but none of the sort of mission of new atheism perhaps might seem to survive. And the one thing I would say about that is that one hope that I have for this sort of inquiry is that not only will it give us some reason to think that beliefs don't typically play a part in the understanding of religion, though sometimes they do, it also helps us to identify what was objectionable about religious belief in the first place. The reason religious belief was objectionable was because it involved the third feature of the thing that I mentioned. That is to say, it involved a certain kind of coercive or normative element which can be manifested in religion. And that's something, whether or not it is in fact underpinned by belief, is that third kind of manifestation of belief that I think it is reasonable to propose and to attempt to combat in the world today. So that, for instance, the sorts of things that may or may not depend on beliefs, but certainly do happen, that we ought to be commenting on things like what happens in even in Britain, but certainly many other countries, with Islamic treatment of women, with the controversy over the Muhammad cartoons, various attitudes that churches have towards homosexuality and other kinds of forms of life, where there's a coercive element which I think is antithetical to a liberal view of society. And one can identify that and combat that independently of whether one thinks it's backed by beliefs at all. That's the thing that is doing harm that I think the new atheists are right to identify and to oppose. Okay, thank you very much.